Leiferson, coming at you from Tawai Panamu, the South Island of New Zealand. It's the afternoon of Thursday, the 3rd of January. This is my first show of the new year, 2019. I'm sitting here in a bunch of weeds by a tidal flat and a river. The tide is pretty far out. Like, if I wanted to actually go swimming in the ocean, I'd have to walk about, maybe close to a kilometer. But I can walk about 100 meters and swim in the river. But I already swam in another river today, the Anataki, thanks to my beautiful friend and massage therapist, Julia, who took me there after a great transcendental massage. I'd really like to thank Jill Stanley at UCY-TV for her 6 or 7 years of very, very dedicated public service to investigative journalism and media awareness platform providing. And she had a hiatus from UCY-TV back from September until about a month ago. And now she's brought us back online. And it's really good to be doing my weekly show again. I recorded quite a few really important interviews in 2018. And the year is getting off to a good start. This show is going to be kind of a retrospective look at 2018, which now in the past day that I've sat down and kind of made an outline of all the really cool stuff that I did and that happened to me and that I experienced and all the really nice people I met. And it was a really an amazing, fantastic, very intense, full-on, fruitful, and varied year. And it's going to be impossible to cover the whole year in just an hour, but I'll try. So first of all, I'll just sort of give a kind of a rundown of, in chronological order of where I was and what I did. This time last year, I was here in Takaka in the Golden Bay area of the South Island, staying with my friend Grant Knowles, and I had recently been renavigated rather than returning to Australia as I had planned, primarily to pick up my new Nikon D4S camera rather than having to have it shipped through the extortionary gauntlet of New Zealand customs. Anyway, I was renavigated to go to visit the Big Island of Hawaii again after a similar sequence of events led me to go there in 2013. And this time, I had just an extraordinarily fantastic time. Even better than before, I stayed in basically three different places and was able to do artwork in exchange for accommodation, which is really cool. And I'd like to thank Kathy Carr and Barbara and everybody at Dragonfly, and then my great new mate, Wally Patch, there at the beach out near Pahoa, for beautiful places to stay. And I'd like to thank Linda Faye Kroll for her beautiful help, and also all the people who made me and my art possible, especially Kenny and Sheena and Sage, Bill and Irene, Seth and Karina and Nikita, the beautiful dog who I took care of for a couple of weeks, Maria Brick, Tim and Karen, Joanna and Tracy, and Liz Glavin and John Atrox, and also Terry Lilly and Millicent Cummings on Kauai, and Patricia O'Neill and Nina Fox on Maui. All these really cool people. Some of these people I didn't see or haven't even met, but it just added to the richness of being there. And I got in touch with Mick Calber, the legendary video photographer who goes up in helicopters and photographs all the volcanic eruptions. He sent me several of his DVDs, and he's actually working on one now of the eruption that just happened while I was there in late April and early into May. Then I left to go back to Australia, and it continued on for almost 100 days. Then in May, I went back to Australia, flew into Sydney, and went and spent some time with my great friend Robert Hogenbaum at the Central Coast Meditation Center in Wambra, which is right near Gosford. That was really cool. Went to the golf course and met Judy Turnbull, my great new friend. Then I went down to Tasmania and visited my friends Wouter and Elise at Lorena. And Wouter went to Belgium for a few weeks, and I stayed on, and I painted what is the largest rock that I've ever painted there with my version of the logo of Wouter's Certified Organic Farm. But that was really cool. And I saw my great friend and spiritual brother, Rob Alliston, who had been staying at a kind of a nursing home there in Sheffield near Cradle Mountain. And he was doing really, really good. This was in June. But it was really interesting because I'm going to do a whole show, a whole radio show and blog post and email about Rob Alliston, because I already interviewed him 3 times for my show back in 2014. And we were planning a trip out to Three Hummock Island, which is off the northwest coast of Tasmania, because he grew up there. His mom, Elizabeth Alliston, wrote a very well-known book about her life there. So Rob had been working on his book for years, and I tried to help him and interview him, and we hung out and hitchhiked to Cradle Mountain once in 2014. And anyway, he's had Parkinson's disease pretty severely since about 2001, 2002, since before I ever actually met him in person. But anyway, but in June, he seemed like he was doing really good. He was having to take some medication and stuff, but he could get around. You know, he had to use a walker to get around, but he seemed in really good spirits. He was having a, had just got his haircut when I was there. We were talking about all this stuff and making plans to go to Three Hummock, and then right before I had to leave, he pulled me aside, and he got really serious, and he asked if he could share something with me, and he said, "Jeff, I overheard some doctors talking about euthanizing me." And I go, "Right. How could that possibly be? You know, you had to be mistaken, or, you know," and I have to be honest, all along, ever since I knew Rob, I never really thought of Parkinson's as a disease that affected people cognitively or mentally. But I was always on the lookout to see if there's even the slightest onset of any kind of what you might call dementia or a cognitive dysfunction. And never once did I detect even the slightest hint of that, not even in June, not even during this last conversation we had. And so I pressed him for details and grilled him, and he insisted adamantly that he actually heard these doctors talking about euthanizing him. And I couldn't really understand why they would want to do that, because he's certainly not a troublemaker at all. Au contraire, he's a very nice person that goes around and visits all the other patients, and he's spends a lot of time working on his book. This is all paid for. They've got plenty of beds, you know. Anyway, I believed him. But I may be the only person he shared that with, because surely there's no way he would share that with the people that work there. And I'm sure none of his family would have been interested in hearing it, because they're quite conservative, and he wasn't really nearly as close to them as he was to me. Anyway, this was in June. In November, when I'm in Rarotonga, I get an email from my friend telling me that Rob passed away. And it really struck me that he had expressed concern about hearing the doctors say they were going to euthanize him. That was in June, and then 4 months later he was dead. After years, he didn't seem any different than he had for years to me. Anyway, we can explore this more in my actual radio show, but I did get to visit him and Grandmother Oak Tree in Sheffield there, and made some really cool friends. Got to do a walk around Cradle Mountain. Visited my really great friends, Alfred Fronson and Deloraine. Then I went back to Melbourne and caught up with my great friend, Jenny Musco, who I've known since 2002, I think, 2001. And she took me down to spend a couple of nights at her holiday house in Inverloch. And we took a day, and she took me to a legendary peninsula called Wilson's Promontory, way down about 4 hours southeast of Melbourne, and it's the southernmost part of the Australian mainland continent. And I'd never been there before, but I'd heard of it for many, many, many years, but had never gone there. And it is where a land bridge actually comes out and connects with Tasmania via Flinders Island, the island where I've spent, and my former partner Elizabeth and I lived for months at a time. So a land bridge comes out from Wilson's Prom, goes straight down to Tasmania, and Flinders Island, the mountains there are some of the peaks sticking up from this mountain range. So Wilson's Prom looked a lot like northeast Tasmania and Flinders Island. It made me feel very, very much at home to be there. So that was really cool. Then I journeyed over to Adelaide and house sat for my beautiful friend Elk Kovarichek. And then she and her family were off to the Czech Republic. And so I was house sitting there, which is really cool. Semaphore is a coastal suburb of Adelaide, and it's got beautiful she-oaks or casuarina trees, which is really, really cool. Just like the ones that I know from Flinders Island, from the Central Desert of Australia, from Bagara up in Queensland, from all around the coast at Darwin, and on the Big Island of Hawaii. And the biggest casuarinas or she-oaks that I've ever seen, three or four times bigger than the biggest ones I've seen in Australia, were on Rarotonga. So that's a really special connection. I call them Cassie, one of my main tree friends, but they don't grow in New Zealand. They probably could, but they just don't yet. So anyway, then I went up to Alice Springs and did some more artwork for my friend's backpacker there, which was really cool. And I didn't have time to go to Uluru this time, like we did in 2017 with my friend Gaetan. We had been living in Darwin and made a trip down there, and that was really, really cool. But this time I painted on the murals, I painted a desert landscape with Uluru, Katajuta, and Attila. Attila is the third sacred mountain. They're all in a straight line. It's the third sacred rock in the central desert. Now, Attila is the only one, or they call it Mount Connors. It's on private property. But the government, I hear, is underway with plans to try to buy it so they can make it part of the national park system, which would be really cool. Then I came back down to Adelaide, and then I had about at least 3 weeks of house sitting before I had to head east. And that was really, really cool, because in Alice Springs I met this really cool bloke named Wambi, an indigenous guy from Tennant Creek who lives in Semaphore now. And he brought me and another guy down to Adelaide, and we camped out at Kubrapiti, which was quite cool. But he's very knowledgeable about a lot of indigenous stuff. And so he told me that a major song line ran down from Semaphore or Adelaide down the west coast of the Floreo Peninsula down towards where you go to Kata or Kangaroo Island. And I had just made that journey and just felt such a beautiful, enchanted energy. I was guided. I was actually looking for rocks to paint because I didn't have very many rocks with me. And I was guided to go right to this little beach at Second Valley that had some of the nicest rocks I've ever found in Australia. Really flat and smooth and kind of shiny, like they might have a bit of schist in there. Just very, very, very special. And I just really felt like the Dreamtime ancestors were smiling on me big time. And I really, really want to go back there. And so then I was getting ready to go to New Zealand, and I was going to fly from Sydney, and I was getting ready to, I was trying to finish up all this artwork and stuff, and so I was kind of leaving it to the last minute, and I was already booking my buses where I was going to have to ride the bus overnight from Adelaide to Melbourne, spend the day in the Melbourne Southern Cross station, take an overnight train to Sydney, and then catch my flight to Auckland. And that was going to just be, I've done it before, but it's just so grueling, and you can't really get anything done. You've got to endure many, many hours in these train stations, which are just loud, practically inhuman environments. So anyway, right at the last second, I got a phone call from a guy that saw my ad on Gumtree, and he said that he was getting ready to drive from Adelaide to Sydney. And it sounded too good to be true, but I told him my time frame, and he goes like, Jeff, well, we can just drive straight through. And I go like, what? Do you know how far that is? It's probably about over 2,000 kilometers. And I go like, you know, people usually take like several days to make that trip. Even truck drivers don't drive straight through. But we did it. And it was a legendary journey. We drove all through the night. This was Jack's first road trip in Australia. He's a fairly young dude, maybe about 19 or 20, who was looking to start his second year of work visa. And he was going to start a new job somewhere up on the East Coast near Newcastle or something like that. And so we drove all through the night. He didn't want me to do any of the driving, even though I offered. But he stayed awake, and I did too. And we didn't hit a single animal, which is just miraculous. It was just like the guardian angels whisked us across there. And actually, just today, I got a email from him in response to a text asking him how he was doing and everything. And so he's relocated there in Eastern Australia, and he's doing fine. So then, in August, I end up back on my beautiful, closest place I have to a home, Great Barrier Island, or Aotea, about 100 kilometers east of Auckland. And I was running about a month earlier than I usually do there. So the weather was a bit chilly and rainy and windy, and not that... It wasn't very clement. In fact, it was inclement quite a bit. But, and it turned out to be quite a challenging visit because of a dental issue that cropped up all of a sudden. But thanks to the help of the people at the medical clinic there, it was all being able to put on hold until I was able to get to a dentist, which happened when I went to Gisborne a few weeks later. And that turned out really cool. But I also want to thank Sean McCarthy for getting me to do my first full-size mural there on Aotea. And I had the best ever rock painting session with all the kids at the O'Kiwi School. And it was very sad to learn about the poison drop of Brodifacoum on Rakitu, or Arid Island, a little island that I see whenever I go and camp out with Grandmother Pahutakaua. And there was some pigs roaming around. They weren't wild. They were ones that belonged to this guy named Marty. But because he's totally derelict in taking care of his farm animals, the only way they can ever get any food is if they can break out of the pen and go scouring through the neighborhoods and people's gardens looking for vegetables to root up and stuff like that. So anyway, they came around, and one night I was in bed and I heard this sound. And I went and looked, and I had a bowl of sort of organic matter that I was going to put on the compost. And it had been tipped over, and a lot of it had been munched. So the pig came in the night and did that. But I love them. I didn't want anything bad to happen to them. But apparently some of them have been shot and made into bacon. Oh, well. So then I came off Great Barrier, went to Gisborne, which was the first time I'd ever been up to the East Cape and that town, and I actually had a really good experience there. I'd like to thank my friend Peter Harris for his hospitality and support, and I did not make it to Lake Waikaremoana yet, but I'm going to go back up there probably in February sometime and go visit the lake. Very sacred spot. And after Gisborne is where Captain James Cook first set foot in New Zealand, and it's quite a controversial thing. And so I went down and stayed with my friend Susan Thrasher in Paraparaumu, which is about an hour north of Wellington. She lives directly across the channel from Kapiti Island, which is like it's just an over-touristed place, but it's like a bird refuge. And she had this really interesting series of television shows hosted by Sam Neill about the voyages of Captain Cook. And I really want to thank Susan because she was able to look on an app on her telephone and she identified my beautiful purple-pink flower that I fell in love with on Great Barrier Island, but no one ever knew what it was called. But it's called Senecio elegans. She was able to find that out for me. Then after Susan's, I went down to the South Island and pretty much came straight out to stay with my friend Kate Burness here in Takaka, who I'm actually staying with now, a very lovely and talented artist from Australia who's lived in New Zealand for about 30 years. And 2 years ago, I stayed with her right before she sold her farm. She's relocated to Takaka, and she's got painting again. And that was really fantastic. And there I caught up with an old friend of mine named Isabel Thistlethwaite, who we had met at Lorena, where she was woofing, and she came and spent a week with me out on Flinders Island. That was in 2014, where we kept in touch and hadn't been able to catch up. She's been working as a nurse here in New Zealand for a couple of years, but she came up to Kate's when I was here in October and spent a few days and then gave me a ride back to Christchurch, and we stopped off at Ward Beach, which is in between Blenheim and Kaikoura, so I could get some of the nicest painted rocks for painting that I've ever been able to find anywhere. So that was a legendary trip. And I want to thank Isabel for making it possible for us to go to that there and also a few other really, really cool places over the past 2 or 3 weeks. So then I went to Rarotonga. It's an island in the Cook Islands, which is about 3,000 kilometers northeast of New Zealand. And just had a mind-blowingly wonderful time. It was totally uncharted territory. But the guy whose Airbnb villa I stayed at, James Vinnebeer, who I interviewed for my show a couple of weeks back, could not have been a cooler person for me to meet and get to know there. And that's a whole story in itself, but I feel like I have a new little home to go to now, including New Zealand, Australia, Hawaii, and now Rarotonga. It could be part of my regular circuit. It's a very user-friendly place. It can be kind of expensive, but this next time I'll have places to stay and people who want art from me. And I probably gave away, oh my God, 30 or 40 painted rocks there just because I was just so touched by how beautiful all the people were, without exception, every single person that I met. Then in the middle of December, I came back to New Zealand and went straight to Christchurch. And there I stayed in a motel owned by this really nice guy named Brian, which is not the typical way I do things, but I needed a place where I could be central to the CBD of Christchurch because I was trying to take care of a lot of stuff I've been needing to do for years, like new contact lenses, some dental work, repairing and replacing camping gear, repairing and replacing photographic gear, all kind of stuff like that. And so I got a lot of it done. And then I decided to go over to the West Coast. Isabel and I caught up and we were able to make a really cool day trip to Castle Hill, and I introduced her to Grandmother Maratini, the giant rock upon Castle Hill, one of the most powerful and sacred places I know of, not only in New Zealand, but in the whole Southern Hemisphere. And so then she was going over to Greymouth to nurse for a couple of weeks, and so I came over there the next day and went up to a place called Karamea, which is as far north as you can go on the west coast of the South Island, a place where I had always heard of, but had never sort of been able or inspired to make a trip up there. So I did, and it was all right. It was right on, I mean, you know, this, we're talking about the worst time of the year to be out on the road, you know, the time like just a few days before Christmas and then on into like New Year's and stuff like that. It can be horrific, but because it was really Isabel inspired me to go over to the West Coast, you know, and hoping that we could do some stuff. So I did. I visited Karamea, and then I went and stayed at this really cool backpacker in Greymouth called Noah's Ark. And I'd like to thank Harry and Linda for having me, because that's one of the, I don't normally stay in backpackers anymore. I did in Alice Springs, but I was doing artwork for them. But the theme here, this place used to be a monastery, and the rooms don't have numbers, they have animals. And so I stayed in the elephant room, and it's been really, really fantastic, because I really felt that the spirit of elephants is calling out to me from being in that room. And then now that I've started looking into it, elephants all around the world are extraordinarily endangered. It's unbelievable the amount of poaching and killing that's going on. And apparently the Trump administration just lifted a ban on elephant parts and ivory, simultaneously with opening the whole eastern seaboard of America to offshore hydrocarbon exploration and exploitation. So it's horrific. The plight of the elephants, the plight of all the koalas in eastern Australia, it's literally koala-geddon going on because of an unbelievable amount of deforestation and habitat destruction in the name of progress, forests being cleared for new shopping centers and housing developments and stuff like that. And then, of course, the beautiful little critically endangered Maui's dolphin right here in New Zealand. I'm sitting here looking out at, I can't see it, but it's right in my field of view to the north, Farewell Spit, a giant 30-kilometer long sand dune that sticks up pretty much north-south, and it heads up towards the Taranaki Basin. Well, this area, South Taranaki and then up the west coast of the North Island, is the only remaining habitat of the Maui's dolphin, and by most estimates, there's less than 60 of them left. 60 individuals, of which maybe a dozen or less are breeding females, and so we just don't know what the possibility is that they're even going to make it, because they keep getting, every year several get trapped in fishing nets, mainly owned by this company called Tally, which I learned that this Tally is this millionaire dude who actually lives just over the hill in Machueca here. And so if one name can be associated with the extinction of Maui's dolphins, it would be Tally, although a lot of other factors are involved. For example, all the pesticide use and the existence of a dioxin factory there in New Plymouth, the hydrocarbon, the Taranaki Basin is the most heavily developed and exploited hydrocarbon region in all of New Zealand, although that process is heavily underway. Even with the Jacinda Ardern apparently saying that no new permits will be granted, that says nothing about the ones that are already granted and that are in operation or that can still come into operation. So I'd also like to thank a legendary new friend that I made, a true brother of the road named Ray Miller, who lives in Karamea. He happened to answer the phone when I rang the caravan park there, and he offered to come down to, because Karamea is really remote. There's no sort of like, you've got to book a shuttle or drive there. There's no sort of like mainstream transport that goes there. And so he offered to come down and pick me up in Westport, which is about an hour and a half. And then when I left, he offered to give me a ride all the way to Greymouth, which is like about 3 hours one way. And that was just so legend. But he used to be a truck driver. I actually got a bit of interview with him telling me about his 23 million kilometers of truck driving over 52 years. And I forgot to ask him how many cups of coffee he might have drunk during that time. Anyway, now that it's New Year's, I'm back here in Takaka, and Kate just came back today to her house after she'd been away house sitting for this guy that had gone on holiday, and now his woofers have returned and his Airbnb people and all the stuff. So I'm sitting out at the ocean. The wind has kind of died down a little bit. It's been a very fantastic year. I'd like to thank my friend Ian McAllister for keeping my boxes of stuff this year, and also my friend Steve Hazy for letting me relocate it to his backpacking repair and manufacturing business. And I recorded some really cool flute tracks with Ian in his new studio back in January. I had quite a few geological epiphanies this year. For example, in Hawaii, awakening to the smell of the sulfur dioxide fumes coming from the lava. That was just so freaky. Being there for this whole eruption sequence was just really, really mind-blowing and actually quite almost scary in a way. I was actually quite glad to get off the island when I did because of the uncertainty of exactly what it was that was happening. And now that they're really sizing this up, they were saying that this eruption was delivering 6 to 9 million cubic meters of lava per day. And it constructed almost 900 new acres of land and destroyed between 800 and 1,000 homes and displaced about 3,000 people. So they say it's the biggest eruption that's happened in over 200 years in Hawaii, in the sense of the amount of lava that came out, which is was quite an honor for me to be there, playing my drum up on top of Mauna Kea when the head broke, and then it was just a couple of days later when all this stuff started. You know, I think I've talked about that before. I don't claim any causal relationship with the whole thing, but it was a very, very, very interesting synchronicity. And getting the beautiful rocks at Ward Beach was a beautiful geological epiphany. I got those beautiful rocks at Second Valley. I got a little trilobite fossil from a guy in the Adelaide Hills. And then Isabel took us to Castle Hill and saw Grandmother Martini. And it's just been a very interesting year geologically. Hung out with a lot of cool trees, my Casuarina friends on the Big Island, and in Rarotonga, and in the Christchurch Botanical Garden. Grandmother Pahutukawa and all the other Pahutukawa trees at Okupu and on Great Barrier Island. Lots of really cool interactions with birds, including the little tui that we rescued, and she was able to be brought back to fullness of health and rejoin her partner. I saw some honu sea turtles actually sort of launching themselves out of the wave when I was playing my flute on the cliff on the Big Island. All kind of birds when I came back to Australia. I've actually saw some king parrots for the first time at Judy Turnbull's house in Gosford, which was really cool, and ringneck parrots, which are a lot like Rosellas in Alice Springs, which was really, really cool, and the Eo, the sacred hawk, calling to me right before the eruption there when I was at Wawa, the tidal pool on the Big Island, swimming. I've had very good luck with bicycles this year. I had my friend's mountain bike that I rode in Hawaii for the last month I was there, which was really cool. And at Golden Bay, at my friend Grant's house, I was able to cycle out to a beach only just a few kilometers from where I'm sitting right now. And coming back one day, that's where I found Huckleberry, the little hound dog, laying by the side of the road. Huckleberry, we're so glad that you've been with us this year.
Oh, Wavy Ups, I'm so glad to be with you. Tell us about our new family member.
Well, yes, at Noah's Ark, there in Greymouth, on our bed was living a little stuffed elephant, and we called her Ellie. And we took her out to the ocean because she had never gone before, and she really wanted to come with us. And so I asked her parents, Harry and Linda, if Ellie could come. And I made a $20 koha on her behalf, and so they've allowed her to come and join us. And now my family has eight kaitiakis, and I'm going to be interviewing them here soon about animal rights. And creatures, what do you think about animal rights?
Oh my God, Wavy Ups, oh my God, we just can't believe how endangered all our families are in the ocean and the land and the air. Oh my God, it's just horrific.
It is. I can't believe it all. And there's only one species to blame, and it's us, Homo sapiens, man the wise. Which leads me to some of my insights of this year. I mean, I guess I could probably do a whole show categorizing the sort of mentalities that I've encountered. But someone whose name I won't mention inspired me to come up with the ARDS, A-R-D-S, Axis of Revolution Delusion Syndrome, where people think that the whole universe revolves around them. And then when I went to the Big Island of Hawaii, where I was for the first, the first two-thirds of my whole 3 or 4 months there, a lot of the time I really felt like I was in a psychiatric penal colony, which was just unbelievable because of just so many people believing just literally kook stuff. And I've been inspired to come up with a new, I guess you could call it a personal effect accoutrement technology that's sort of, to me, it's very symbolic of the world we live in. And it's a, I'm not sure exactly what to call it, but it's a selfie stick. Everybody knows what those are. A selfie stick with a big swollen dildo. You know what that is. It's a fake penis. Okay, a giant fake penis mounted on a selfie stick and then smeared with brown shoe polish and mayonnaise and then dipped in chocolate. The Choco Dild. This is just like, and what you do is walk around, when you see a bunch of people with their selfie sticks walking around, I would just break this out and walk around holding it in front of myself and maybe go up and hold it next to the other people when they're holding their selfie sticks. And then when I do this, I would have someone filming the whole thing, you know, kind of from a distance, just to see what people's reactions might be. But there are subcultures of people. You see groups of them as tourists all over Australia and New Zealand. I'm not going to name any names, but I wouldn't be surprised if they tried to eat this, if they tried to buy it from me or actually eat it. If I went and left it on the table to go to the bathroom, if I came back, I'd probably see a bunch of them standing there licking their mouth. They wouldn't be able to help themselves. A chocolate-covered fake piece of meat on a selfie stick. It would cover all the bases. This year has been interesting for media for me because I was somehow inspired to download and watch every episode of a fantastic TV show from the 1960s called The Fugitive that starred David Janssen as the Dr. Richard Kimball, who was fleeing the law because they had sentenced him to death in the murder of his wife, but he didn't do it. He was looking for the one-armed man that actually did it. And it's just absolutely fantastic television. And he's a very inspiring character. Then also I watched every episode of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And then it was interesting because I was in Hawaii. You know, I learned that David McCallum, who played Elia Kuryakin, is actually still going. At the age of about 84, he looks like he's about not that much older than me. And he's starring in a TV show called NCIS, Naval Criminal Investigative Service, that's been going for 10 or 15 years. So anyway, I was really inspired by his character, so I was getting ready to, I was actually contacting his management firm in Los Angeles right when this whole eruption sequence started, so that kind of threw that off. And then I've also learned that Patrick Stewart is returning to play Jean-Luc Picard in Star Trek, but it's probably going to be another year or two till that comes out. But he's actually got one of my hand-painted rocks that Ian Kerr of Ocean Alliance in Massachusetts gave to him. But my biggest media hero of the year, who someone I've heard about ever since I first came to Australia in the year 2000, he's a, I hesitate to use the word comedian because he's actually far more than like just a comedian. He's an actor, an intellect, a probably quite philosophical, but he's well known for these characters that he's portrayed that are brilliant satirical piss takes on the Australian mentality and personality. These characters are named, for example, there's several, but the three that I'm most familiar with are Barry McKenzie, Dame Edna Everidge, and the Dr. Sir Leslie Colin Patterson, cultural attaché from the Court of St. James. Oh my God, I just can't believe when I watch these characters, especially Sir Les, it just, I laugh so hard, but it's just absolutely brutal. Brutal denunciation. And watching some documentaries and interviews with Humphreys, you know, they don't name any names, but they actually do show a few video clips of some of the people that he modeled these characters on. But that is just so, oh my God, it's just beyond belief. And apparently he did a new thing just a few months ago, and he's claiming that he's going to revive Sir Les. But I want to paint a rock and get it to David McCallum and to Barry Humphreys. And maybe Barry Humphreys, I'll try to deliver it to him in person. But I strongly recommend that you watch this. And probably my most listened to CD of this year is a band called Ambrosia, and it's their first album called Ambrosia. I remember listening to this when it came out in 1975, they had a song called Holding On to Yesterday that was all over Top 40 radio. But then, in 1986, I remember my friends had it up in North Dakota where I was helping them build a new recording studio, and I listened to it then, but forgot about it until, I don't know how, it came back on my radar when I was on Great Barrier Island, but I downloaded it and listened to it, and I really appreciate how good of musicians they are. It's very prog rock. You hear elements of, like, Yes and King Crimson and Kansas and Pink Floyd, but you also hear a lot of Beatles influence, and it's actually, this first album was engineered by the legendary Alan Parsons, who's actually been on my radar a lot this year for some reason. I remember when I had lunch with the Italian astrophysicist and musician Fiorella Terenzi in Los Angeles, whatever year was that, 1993 or something like that. She, right from meeting with me, she was going to meet with Alan Parsons. And so that was really cool. But so Ambrosia is some really good music to check out. And remember, only a true blonde can have brown hair and still be a blonde. So I guess that's enough of my recap of 2018. I'd like to thank legendary 1080 activist Clyde Graff for his awesome work, and Dr. Fiona McQueen for her work on 1080, Jill Stanley at UCY-TV, Peter Kirby, author of Chemtrails Exposed, The New Manhattan Project, and James Vinnie Beer on Rarotonga, and Terry Lilly and Stuart Simonson, Ian Kerr at Ocean Alliance, Glenn Edney on the North Island of New Zealand, all the whales and dolphins, all the kingdoms of life, Mitakaye Oyasan. And I've got a new discipline that I'm developing for this year. It's called equifique, equine fecology, or in common parlance, the study of horse shit, because there's just so much of it out there that, especially when it comes to the whole climate change thing, oh my God, I just can't believe how far that's all gone. Anyway, we must strive to get rid of all of our carbon. On that note, I'll leave you. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson coming at you from beautiful New Zealand. Keep it in the road, and God has blessed the Homo sapiens. Good day.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.